From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. No further witnesses are scheduled for the House impeachment inquiry. What comes next? We'll look at the scenarios with legal and political analysts. Also, the state of the 2020 field of presidential candidates. Wednesday night's debate was overshadowed by the day's marathon impeachment hearing. We'll look at the big challenge facing second-tier candidates attempting to qualify for next month's debate here in Los Angeles. It's Film Week at 11, featuring reviews of Frozen 2. Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and the comedic drama Knives Out. It's Air Talk, right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to be back with you in the 10 o'clock hour here on 89.3 KPCC. Hetty just sharing that story about the unveiling yesterday of Tesla's electric pickup truck. That was so funny. If you get a chance to see the video of the supposedly shatterproof driver's side window, very funny. Well, you know, in this very pre-planned world in which we live, where everything is supposedly tested ahead of time, it's kind of funny to see something that doesn't go as scheduled. But when it comes to the impeachment hearings over the past several days, it seems that people's views going into the hearings largely reinforced as to whether they think President Trump is guilty of the high crimes and misdemeanors associated with impeachment. The Senate Intelligence Committee holding hearings over the past couple of weeks. Now the question is, will this go to the Judiciary Committee and articles of impeachment be drawn up? Will there be additional witnesses before House committees? We don't know. So we're going to take a look forward, though, to see where this all goes. But as you just heard on NPR News, President Trump called into the show Fox and Friends on the Fox News channel, and he was on the air for over 50 minutes this morning.
The bottom line is all of those witnesses, they're all shifty shifts. Don't forget, there was no due process. You can't have lawyers. We couldn't have any witnesses. Right. We want to call the whistleblower. But you know who I want as the first witness? Because, frankly, I want a trial. You know, I could think I could have it.
You want a trial?
Whatever I want. Oh, I would. Look. Number one, they should never, ever impeach. This is not impeach. I watched five people on your network yesterday say there's nothing here.
All right. Joining us is Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter for the L.A. Times. She's in the Senate Press Gallery. Joins us right now. Jennifer, thanks very much. First of all, can you just kind of give us the lay of the land there? What sorts of conversations are going on Capitol Hill after these 2 weeks of testimony?
Well, lawmakers all left late last night, actually, after the hearings ended. You know, as you kind of insinuated, both parties have kind of gone back to their camps. Democrats feel like they had a very good sprint of 10 days, I guess, from start to finish, 10 days of hearings. They feel like they were able to make their arguments. The witnesses, in fact, you know, provided several new details that we didn't know from their first closed-door depositions. Republicans, you know, they were a bit meandering in their defense of the president, kind of switching from different defenses throughout the testimony, but they feel like they did what they had to do, which was put out an alternative narrative. And in fact, one of the Republicans who was kind of viewed as on the fence, Will Hurd of Texas, came out and said that he does not see an impeachable offense here.
Well, and it was interesting to see the language both Democrats and Republicans were trying out to see sort of, you know, which would stick for how they characterize the behavior of President Trump as related by all those who were providing testimony. So, Jennifer, what are the next steps here? Is anything going to happen next week, Thanksgiving week?
Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who's essentially currently in charge of the investigation, has been very tight-lipped about the next steps. The last thing he said in the hearing yesterday was that he views Trump's offenses as worse than President Nixon's crimes. Of course, he was removed from office, or he left office voluntarily when it became clear he was going to be impeached. But he did not commit to putting forward articles of impeachment. So when lawmakers come back after Thanksgiving, we're expecting his committee will release a report kind of summarizing what they found so far. And then they would hand off to the House Judiciary Committee, which would write articles of impeachment.
Or they could call their own witnesses, presumably.
Right. And they could do both at the same time. We would expect the House Judiciary Committee would give the president a chance to weigh in, obviously, most likely in writing, not in person. But a lot of this is kind of up in the air because Democrats have kind of hit pause ahead of Thanksgiving week. I will say it's been a very strenuous 2 weeks up here, and I'm sure lawmakers and staff feel like they do need a bit of a breather before moving on to their next steps.
So are they gone all next week, or do they come back after this weekend?
They're gone all the next week.
Jennifer, thank you very much. Appreciate your setting the scene on Capitol Hill. She's congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Also with us, David Rivkin, who held positions in the Department of Justice as well as White House Counsel Office, elsewhere in the federal government, partner in the D.C. firm of Baker Hostetler. Mr. Rivkin, good to have you with us again. One of the challenges, it seems to me, for Republicans here, particularly with a Senate trial, is that the president is being very clear. He thinks he did absolutely nothing wrong. He calls the call perfect, that there was absolutely nothing here that was untoward in his relationship with Ukraine. For the senators who, like Will Hurd, think the president was not right in what he did, even though they don't think the actions are impeachable. Does that make it challenging for them to defend the president?
I don't think so. The exercise that the Senate is going to conduct is the impeachment trial. What's an issue? It's not a foreign policy seminar, which is largely, at best, what the hearings this week were. Nobody is going to be debating the wisdom or lack thereof of the president's foreign policy substance or process. They're going to be debating whether it's a high crime and misdemeanor, and it doesn't even get close to this, whatever you think about the wisdom of a president's policy. To elaborate, the notion that there was no legitimate reason for the president exercising his core discretionary foreign affairs powers to ask Ukraine to investigate whether you call it discredited theory, as a lot of media does, or not, the notion that there were Ukrainian interference into U.S. 2016 election. He did not ask Ukraine to make something up. He asked Ukraine to investigate. The notion that that is somehow high crime and misdemeanor to me is ludicrous. Let me give you a falling thought experiment. Let's say, as unlikely as it is, that Putin dies tomorrow. There's a new Russian president, okay? And we improve our relations with Russia. We're about to sign a new arms control treaty or something like that. Do you think it would be illegitimate for President Trump to ask the new Russian leader to look at what the Russians did in 2016? Do you think anybody would mind that? Wouldn't it be, in fact, exactly what the Democrats have been asking for the last several years, which is to take foreign interference seriously? Now, the fact is being characterized as somehow Trump seeking political benefits by asking Ukraine to do this is a characterization. It's not a fact. And second, as I've said before and written for the Wall Street Journal, the notion that you can taint what is otherwise a legitimate exercise of foreign policy, again, whatever you think about its wisdom, because you're going to gain political advantage from it, and that somehow taints it, it's ludicrous. Everything the president in a democracy does has political benefits. Effort to get free trade agreement with China has political benefits. Ditto for nuclear deal with North Korea. Okay?
All right.
The whole thing is absurd.
Ms. Rivkin, I know you have to go. I have a lot of questions for you otherwise, but we'll let you go. Thank you so much for being with us, David Rivkin. Let me bring in, for a different perspective, from the University of Michigan, law professor Barbara McQuaid. Professor McQuaid, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts about what we just heard from David Rivkin, his analysis that essentially presidents do this all the time.
Yeah, you know, it sounds to me a lot like echoes of what we hear from Attorney General William Barr, this idea that if the president does it, it's not illegal, that as chief executive, everything he touches is thereby by definition lawful. And I just don't believe that's the case. I think the president is not above the law. And when it comes to exercising foreign policy, we have to remember the president's constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And so I think when the president is demanding a thing of value, fraudulent investigations, in fact, merely an announcement of investigations that he can use to personally benefit himself for political advantage in exchange for the performance of an official act, that is the delivery of military aid and the granting of a White House visit, is an abuse of power. It meets the definition of bribery, and I think it is an impeachable offense.
So Mr. Rifkin's point was this thought experiment that if Vladimir Putin was no longer resident of Russia, you have someone else friendly to the U.S., would it be wrong to withhold aid in exchange for an investigation of what Russia did regarding the 2016 election? So what's the difference as you see it?
The purpose of it, if the purpose is to benefit the United States, to fulfill the president's responsibility of acting in the best interest of the country, then I think it's permissible. We've seen evidence of that Joe Biden advocated for withholding of military aid to Ukraine while they were working on corruption in that country. That, I think, is a perfectly legitimate use of the power of the United States, withholding it for some purpose that is in the national interest. What happened here instead is what small-town mayors and big-city mayors do all the time when they are charged with bribery, and that is acting not in the best interest of their constituents in the country, but instead in their own best interest.
So so is there no overlap? So if, again, using Ms. Rifkin's thought experiment, so Mr. Trump was arguably benefiting from Russian interference in the 2016 election. So if there, it would potentially be against his interest to withhold aid based on an investigation of Russia, but it helps his interest for the very same thing. I mean, wouldn't there be a national benefit in both cases? One would not benefit the president personally, the other would benefit him, but couldn't you argue both are in national benefit?
As I understand the facts with regard to Ukraine, there's no national benefit. As we heard from Fiona Hill yesterday, this idea that Ukraine somehow participated in election interference in 2016 is a false narrative. And so I think the distinction is the president acting in his own personal interest or in the best interest of the country? If you can satisfy the requirement that his conduct is in the best interest of the country for withholding military aid or encouraging genuine investigations, then I think the argument is different. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is an effort to promote President Trump's own personal interest. You know, a comparison might be a case I handled, supervised, involving the former mayor of the city of Detroit. He was had the power to award contracts to contractors to do city public works contracts. But he chose to award them to the contractors who were willing to pay bribes. And so although he had the power to do that, and yes, it was in the best interest of the city to have this work done, it was in the best interest of the city to have the work done by the contractor who would offer it at the lowest cost and do the best job, not the one that would line his pockets. And so in this instance, what we see is the president is exercising lawful authority to engage in foreign policy, but he is choosing to do it in a way that benefits himself personally as opposed to what's in the best interest of our country.
Professor, we appreciate your being with us from the University of Michigan, law professor Barbara McQuaid, also joining us from Professor Emeritus of Political Science, University of Chicago. He's also a columnist for Real Clear Politics and a number of other conservative publications. Charles Lipson. Professor, thank you for being with us. Your response to what we just heard from Professor McQuaid of the University of Michigan?
First of all, thank you, Larry. the way I heard her argument is that she is convinced that the President of the United States used his office lawfully to with withholding aid was lawful, but not for the purposes of benefiting himself personally. I certainly agree that if that is the case, it is a problem. Here, let me explain why I think that that's a bit of the wrong way to look at it.
All right.
I think that there are three overriding questions here. The first is, what did the president really want from Ukraine? The second is, can the Democrats prove he wanted something so improper, so lawless, that it meets the high bar for high crimes, misdemeanor, bribery, or treason, which are the ones that are laid out in the Constitution? And then the third, which has almost never been discussed, is, what's the rush? Do voters think that the charges are so serious, the proof so convincing, and the need to remove the president so urgent that it cannot wait until the election next November? Now, what Professor McQuaid said is that she is convinced that the purpose that Trump withheld the aid briefly, 5 weeks, was for personal benefits. I actually think that that's probably true, but not certainly true. And the president and his allies have an alternative explanation. And the alternative explanation is, this is one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. People put it in the four or five most corrupt countries on the planet. They've just got a new president who has pledged to go after corruption. But we all know politicians sometimes pledge something and then don't do it. So the U.S. has a national interest in going after corruption. It wants to investigate those issues, and it has urged that around the world. One of the two or three most corrupt sectors in all of Ukraine is the energy sector. For understandable reasons, there's huge amounts of cash coming in, and you can hand it out to friendly politicians. Oligarchs can control it.
Sure.
So forth. So their argument is, we have a legitimate purpose. Now, I think that that's not the most likely explanation, but you made the point yourself. Couldn't both be true? There's a legitimate and there's a political purpose.
All right, and we'll see if there's a Senate trial. Those competing arguments undoubtedly playing out. Thank you, Sir Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, Political Science, University of Chicago. We have many more guests to join us in the minutes ahead. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Next hour on Film Week, it's the sequel Frozen 2, returning director Jennifer Lee, and the voice cast of Kristen Bell, Idina Menzel, and Josh Gad. Tom Hanks stars as children's TV host Fred Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and Knives Out, the comedic drama written and directed by Rian Johnson, Daniel Craig, Chris Evans, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Toni Collette star in the film. But that's just the start. Many more films. Plus, we're going to talk about your favorite parodies, films that make fun of a particular genre. You remember Airplane, for example? One of my favorites. So we're going to talk about those coming up next hour, Film Week, here on 89.3 KPECC. But right now, our focus is on the 2 weeks of impeachment hearings before the House Intelligence Committee. The question is, what comes next? Joining us is Jeffrey Engel, who's director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He's co-author of Impeachment, an American History. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us. So take us through what the next steps in this process are. If this goes to trial in the Senate, what is that going to look like?
It's going to look pretty much like the movie Airplane that you're going to be looking at next hour. And that's going to be a little bit of a farce because we're going to see everyone retreat to their own partisan sides, most likely. What's going to happen on a practical level is that right now the House Intelligence Committee will pass its information onto the House Judiciary Committee, which is traditionally where we see articles of impeachment drawn up. Those would be put to the whole House, and if they are approved by a majority, then the trial begins in the Senate. And at that point, we have a very curious situation that we have senators who, of course, are known to be long-winded. They'll each be required to sit passively while the president's advocates and the president's detractors essentially argue out the case in front of them with the Chief Justice John Roberts presiding. Ultimately, interestingly enough, they are not actually required to convict someone based upon the evidence.
And so this is all going to be very public. Will the deliberation of the senators before their vote happen privately, or will that be debate on the floor of the Senate?
Traditionally, that has happened privately. Now, we have to remember that when I say traditionally, it's really critical to note we have only a very, very few number of examples to go by with precedent, and the Senate is allowed to write its own rules every single time. So the Nixon case was different than Andrew Johnson's case, Clinton case different than Nixon, and we can expect that this next case will have its own rules. So traditionally, those kinds of debates will be held behind closed doors, though all of the trial portion, if you will be held out in public.
Who would be the prosecutor typically, and who would provide defense of the president?
The prosecutor would be people who are called the House managers, that is to say people from the House of Representatives who will come over and essentially be prosecuting attorneys trying to demonstrate what the president did wrong to prove the case of what the House has passed, the articles that the House has passed. We should note that one of the most famous of these for President Clinton was Lindsey Graham, who, of course, is now one of President Trump's biggest supporters. The defense team, if you will be, frankly, whomever the president would like to put there. It can be congresspeople. It can be lawyers. It could be anyone he likes. It could be Rudy Giuliani, for all we know.
So it could be potentially the prosecutors. I mean, could hypothetically be Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler could be the prosecutors, for example.
That is exactly who it could be. The Democrats will essentially have to find out. I shouldn't say the Democrats, because we're trying to keep this nonpartisan if possible. The people who voted for the articles of impeachment will have free rein to choose whomever among them they wish to best present the case to the Senate.
All right. And then for the defense of the president, would that be someone from the Senate, from the House, someone the White House could choose? Who would that be?
It could not be someone from the Senate, because someone from the Senate would have to be sitting as a
juror, yeah.
Or actually, technically not a juror. One of the key things that Justice Rehnquist, the Supreme Court justice who oversaw the Clinton case, made a point of is that the senators are not jurors, because jurors are required just to adjudicate right or wrong, guilty or innocent. They are instead technically a court, which means that they are supposed to determine not just right or wrong, but ultimately what is best for the country. So one could conceive of a case where the senators all agree that the president is guilty of the articles of impeachment and yet choose not to find him guilty of an impeachable offense, because that is something that would require his removal from the presidency, and they could determine that's not in the best interest of the country.
So find him guilty but not remove him. That's a possibility?
Linguistically, yes. You know, if they find him guilty of the articles of impeachment, then he is removed from office. What they could do is say, we believe he is guilty, but we do not want to find him guilty because we do not want him removed from office. The semantics get really tight.
Yeah.
But there is definitely a way in which the senators are allowed to move beyond merely innocence or guilt to determine what they think is best to go forward for the country.
All right. And how much input is the White House able to have in the defense of the president?
As much as little as they want. Andrew Johnson essentially took a step back, if you will, in his case. Bill Clinton was actively following his case in the Senate, even though he tried to make it appear to the public that he had better things to do to try and make it seem as though he was only interested in affairs of state. The truth of the matter is we know he followed very carefully. So this White House will have as much opportunity as it likes to put on what it thinks is the best defense. I mean, President Trump on the television today said that he is looking forward to a trial so he can can put forward his best defense, well, he will get every opportunity if that's the case.
Who defended Bill Clinton last time?
He had several of his actual defense lawyers. There was nobody from the House who defended him, per se, whereas all the House managers were people who were actually members of Congress.
So were those attorneys that were hired by the president, essentially, to defend him in the Senate?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. One of the things that the House, that the Clinton White House did was essentially try to find various former members of the Senate who had great esteem and political standing, former Senate majority leaders, for example, or perhaps Senator John Glenn of Ohio was one that they considered to come in and essentially be the lead counsel, someone who could look the other senators in the eye and say, I know what it's like to sit in your seat because I did so for 30 years. Here is how you should vote. But the actual lawyering, if you will, was done by people that were simply hired, as we would any defense lawyer.
We're talking with Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He's co-author of Impeachment in American History, published just about a year ago. I also wonder about the timetable that we've heard Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has talked about, trying to do this within a couple of weeks, 6 days a week of essentially trial in the Senate. I don't even recall, and I was on the air covering it, with the Clinton impeachment. How long did that last, and would this be much quicker than that?
It was about a month, and one of the key things to note about the Clinton case is that the Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott at the time, and the Senate Minority Leader, Tom Daschle at the time, both essentially agreed before the trial started that the president was not going to be convicted. They both agreed the president had done something despicable. They both agreed the president had done something moral. They both agreed the president had done something that was a lie, but neither of them thought it was a high crime. Neither of them thought it was an assault against the body politic and the nation. So they essentially agreed amongst themselves that he was not going to be convicted. So their goal was basically to get through the trial as painlessly as possible, to keep it from destroying the Senate, in their words. What that meant was, essentially, because the verdict was pre-cooked, if you will, inside, behind closed doors, that allowed each of the senators to essentially vote along party lines and know that there was no danger whatsoever in doing so for them individually. We may see the same thing in this case, though I think there's unlikely to be the same sort of collegiality between the Senate Majority Leader today, Mitch McConnell, and Chuck Schumer from New York, the Minority Leader. Neither of them seems to be on the exact same page of what to do with President Trump.
Well, and there's the further complication. You've got several of the Democratic senators running for president, so they're going to be on the shelf for however long the impeachment trial takes place, if it does take place in the Senate, because they're just going to be there, having to be there listening to testimony. How do you see that factoring into the process?
You know, I that has been raised a lot. I genuinely don't think it's going to factor into the process. It's going to be extraordinarily inconvenient for those senators who would rather be on the campaign trail. But the truth is, if you watched the debate among the Democratic contenders the other night, after a day of hearings in the House for impeachment, most of the talk and most of the subtext was actually about impeachment. So it strikes me that whether the senators are sitting there in the cellar of the Senate listening to this debate, or whether they are on the campaign trail, the country is going to be focused on the question of impeachment less so than the issues that those senators might wish to talk about, less so than health care, less so than criminal justice reform. If the nation is concerned with impeachment, it strikes me it doesn't really matter where the senators are, because that's what the nation is going to be focused on.
Jeffrey Engel, I just realized I held you past the time you're supposed to be with us. I'm so sorry. I missed that. I hope I haven't caused you to miss another appointment that you needed to get to. I want to thank you for being with us. That's Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He's one of the authors of Impeachment, an American History. That's one of the things my job is, to pay attention to everybody where they're scheduled and make sure that we don't make them miss another appointment on media very often, where they're going to be talking about this as well. I also just want to let you know, coming up, we're going to be focused on the debate that was held Wednesday Wednesday night. It was the lowest rated of the debates because viewers might have been a little bit wrung out from the day's marathon impeachment hearings. So MSNBC's ratings not particularly good for the debate. But there were a number of interesting issues that were raised and performances as well. We're going to play some clips from that debate, and we're going to be talking with our political analysts on the program, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, and Anna Kasparian, host and executive producer of The Young Turks. She'll be providing a Democratic perspective on what happened in the debates. We'll also hear them talk about what comes next in the impeachment hearing process. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and make sure you stay tuned for Film Week. It comes up at 11 o'clock with our critics reviewing Frozen 2. Kristen Bell, Idina Menzel, and Josh Gad's voices are all back. Jennifer Lee returns as director in the sequel, and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood with Tom Hanks, faithful supporter of KPCC, starring. Back right after this live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just want to remind you that whatever the next step is in the House impeachment inquiry, we'll be bringing you extensive coverage right here on 89.3 KPCC, just as we did for every minute of every one of the public hearings before the House Intelligence Committee. Joining me now to talk about the impeachment process before we segue into talking about last Wednesday night's Democratic candidates debate is Anna Kasparian, host and executive producer of The Young Turks, and Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. Anna, thank you very much for being with us. First of all, what you think would be the best strategy for Democrats to undertake moving the impeachment process forward?
I think the Democrats have done a decent job in the impeachment inquiry so far. They're hyper-focused on, you know, the call for investigations into Biden. I wish that they didn't limit the scope so much and maybe focused a little more on possible financial incentives for Donald Trump. But nonetheless, I think that the way that they're handling this with the public hearings has been quite effective. At least that's what the polls indicate.
Well, and probably difficult to pursue the financial angle, at least in part, because they don't even have access to the president's tax records or anything that they would be able to look at. So they'd have to go through other measures to get that material, right?
Well, that's correct. But there are other issues that many people are concerned about, including some of the business relationships he has with various foreign countries, including Saudi Arabia and Turkey. So I wish there was more of an investigation into that, but it's OK. We'll focus on the foreign meddling in U.S. elections.
So you think there's enough there that this should go to the Judiciary Committee? They should drop articles of impeachment and take a full House vote?
At this point, I think that there's an abundance of evidence indicating that Trump directly demanded these investigations. He involved his personal lawyer, who had no business involving himself in our U.S. foreign policy. And so I think that there's certainly enough to vote on the articles of impeachment. Now, what happens in the Senate is a completely different story.
Anna Kasparian of the Young Turks with us, Sean Walsh. So, Sean, you've heard part of the conversation since joining us on the line. Your thoughts about going forward with this, and particularly the challenge, in a sense, Republican senators face if there's a trial there, because the president, he's saying, you know, this call was perfect. I've done absolutely nothing wrong. My sense of Republican senators is generally they'll cede. He shouldn't have done this. Rudy Giuliani shouldn't have been doing, but this isn't impeachable. So does that leave them at all in a quandary? Sean? All right. Well, we'll try and get him back on, hear what he has to say. Anna Kasparian, your thoughts on whether this leaves senators, Republican senators, in a predicament?
Well, it's interesting because if you pay close attention to the beginning of this impeachment investigation, Republicans went from saying there's no quid pro quo, absolutely no quid pro quo, to realizing through the various Trump administration officials who have testified against him that there absolutely is quid pro quo. So then they move the goalposts, and now they're saying, well, you know, it's not a big deal. It's not an impeachable offense. Well, you guys were saying that you would be willing to convict him in the Senate if there was evidence of quid pro quo. Now that we have that evidence, they've moved the goalposts. So, look, I think that this is incredibly problematic. And the real question is, what's more important to these Republican lawmakers? Protecting our democracy, protecting our Constitution, or protecting their political careers by pandering to Trump supporters? I think that's really what's happening right now. I think if Trump was polling low among his base, things would be very different among Republican lawmakers.
Yeah, I wonder because, and Sean, you can speak to this, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. My sense is that, yes, of course, Republicans are supporting the president because they know, and you've made this point, if they don't, there's a huge political price to pay. But do you think that they authentically believe this rises to the level of impeachment and they're going against what their, you know, moral compass says?
I think most don't believe it rises to the level of impeachment, number one. But number two, since 25 of them are up for re-election in this next election cycle, the fact that they're going to be on recess for roughly 2 weeks will, I think, be a good barometer as to whether their constituents feel this rises to a level of impeachment. And how you see them publicly perform in the next several months, I think, will be largely reflected on what input they get back from their districts and their states over the next 2 weeks.
And the president and his supporters have to be heartened by a new Emerson poll that was conducted through Wednesday, which found that the president's approval rating has increased over the last month, 48% approval, 47% disapproval among registered voters. That's a bounce in 5 percentage points since October. Support for impeachment has flipped since October, 48% supporting, 44% opposing in October. It's now 45% opposed to impeachment, 43% in support. So you're within the margin of error there. Sean, I have to assume that, again, that's only through Wednesday, so we don't have it all the way through all the testimony that's been heard, but that has to be somewhat heartening to the president's defenders.
Yes, and nothing changed in these hearings. I think most of the people, Larry, who are either, you know, strongly Democratic-leaning or Republican-leaning didn't move an inch. Some of the independents or people that weren't focused, that didn't move their needle. This was not the Nixon impeachment hearings where people literally hung on every word that came forward, number one. And number two, this is really a flip from what actually happened in the last two impeachment proceedings, insofar as we had special counsels in Nixon and we had special counsels with Clinton that had done a year and a half, 2 years worth of work. Here, this issue literally came up a couple of months ago. The special counsel really has been the House, and they brought this issue forward, but they haven't had the due diligence and that kind of effort up to this date. I don't see anything coming forward. The president's still going to stick by executive privilege, so I don't think you're going to see Pompeo, the vice president, or anybody else come forward. So I just don't see anything moving the needle. Now, you can say right or wrong, good or bad.
Yeah.
Giuliani have been doing
that. Let's talk ethics, Sean. So are Republicans concerned that with the president's behavior relative to Ukraine, that if that is evidenced in a variety of other areas involving U.S. security and foreign relationships, concerned that even not just this incident, but what it says about the president's conduct generally, that questions about whether he's suitable to serve as president, given his willingness to do this.
I think that's absolutely right, Larry, but it's not going to come through the impeachment process, which many people view as very, very political. It's going to come through the what I call the electoral impeachment process. It's going to come through whomever the Democratic nominee is who puts their case forward that Donald Trump is not suitable to be the president of the United States, either through vulgarity or through ethics or whatever purposes, and then they convince the public to basically convict Donald Trump and throw him out of office. And so we've got a democratic process that allows for that to happen. I do think those polls you talked about are reflective of the fact that the public wants to make up their own mind about whether Donald Trump is fit to be president or not, and they will do so in a little less than a year. And I also think, though, that there are Republican women, there are women across the board that are just tired of Donald Trump. And so they may not want to impeach him, but he better do something to turn around what I'm seeing as a disturbing trend from his Republican support.
Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, Anna Kasparian, host and executive producer of The Young Turks. Anna, I wanted to ask you about, you know, strategically from a Democratic standpoint, what do Democrats gain if this goes to the Senate and the president isn't removed from office? And aside from believing that they've done the right thing morally, is there a concrete benefit beyond that?
Well, in my eyes, there is a concrete benefit aside from doing the right thing. These Republican senators do not want to be on the record giving Donald Trump a pass when there's, again, an abundance of evidence in the form of Trump administration officials testifying against him, indicating that he asked for a foreign government to meddle in our elections. So they didn't want this process to go forward. They don't want to be on the record. They don't want history to look back at their legacy and judge them the way that they should be judged if they give Donald Trump a pass. So I think that this is important. I think that it's important to hold people in positions of power accountable if they do not protect our democracy. And that's exactly what will happen with, you know, senators like Lindsey Graham, who are, again, much more concerned about their relevance and their political career as opposed to protecting our democratic process.
We'll continue with Anna and Sean right after a very brief break. And we're going to look back Wednesday night's debate, which was somewhat overlooked compared to the previous ones because of all the attention focused on the House impeachment inquiry hearings. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk on KPCC.